My name is Danielle, and I am an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Michael C. and Sue, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Yumi will read the preamble.
Hi, my name is Yumi. I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees. For AA membership, we are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Okay. Please join in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Harry will read the steps.
I am Harry. I'm an alcoholic. 12 steps. 1, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Mary will read the traditions.
Tradition 1. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2. For our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4. Each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5. Each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6. An AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. And I think I forgot to say my name. No, I'm just going to say I forgot to say I'm married. I'm alcoholic.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker, who will begin for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Kyle.
Hi, my name is Kyle, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is June the 16th of 2006. I'm working on step 4, and Kevin is my sponsor. First of all, I just want to express my gratitude for everybody here and for the Atlantic Group and for everybody who's been a part of my journey to the light, because it was really dark for a long time. And I take comfort in knowing that you all understand that gratitude, everybody here. Start at the beginning. My family, I come from an alcoholic family. And it's also really important to mention that I come from a recovery family. And that's really what saved my life. I mean, back when I was active, seeing my dad get sober and see him get sober through AA was really what saved me. And it was definitely the difference between me losing everything and being someone that was caught early. And it's been such a gift. And so if you have children who you're worried about in any way, if there's problem children, anything, I beg you just to stay sober. This is a program of attraction, and that was the best thing that they ever did. I never listened to a word my parents said, ever, ever, you know. And but I saw him get sober, and I saw it through AA. So right about the time I was 13 was when my parents got sober. So my whole life kind of came crashing down at that point when I realized that everybody's family was not that screwed up, you know. So, and the whole family kind of goes to rehab at that point. And my whole life is being ripped apart by drugs and alcohol. And what do? I start using drugs and alcohol. And my first drink was I didn't really like. I really didn't like the taste. But I was 13. I was at Hungry Howie's Pizzeria, where I had a job. And they gave me a shot of Southern Comfort, I think. And, you know, it's the same story that you hear in a lot of meetings where, you know, I took this drink, and I felt this burn hit my chest, and that was a solution from then on out. You know, it really was. And it was really... It's really interesting because I didn't get in a whole lot of trouble when I was drinking, and that would be that came to be a real stumbling block for me. That the drinking part was a lot of the good parts of my story. You know, that was when I was the most happy. It was all that sober time in between that I really had a problem with. You know, that irritability, the discontent, the, you know, and I was very physically abusive and verbally abusive to everybody I knew. And, you know, I hated the taste of alcohol, you know, but to me it just was kind of this necessary evil to get what I wanted, you know, and that actually became sort of a running theme for the rest of my drinking career and active career. Was there was something I wanted, and no matter what was in between, be it a person, be it an institution that I held dear, be it whatever, it really didn't matter. It just was a necessary evil to get what I wanted. And very quickly, you know, I was completely out of control. I thought that I was going to go to jail, and I was self-mutilating and ended up in a mental hospital. I was institutionalized, and I was 16. That's when I was 16, and that was the last drink I had was before I went into the hospital. And you know, when I was in the hospital, I was on a 15-minute watch, and I really thought everybody else had the problem, you know, which it's so insane to think about, you know, that I couldn't be trusted. Not only could I not be trusted in the outside world, and had to be institutionalized, thank you, that within the institution, I couldn't be trusted for 15 minutes by myself. And everybody else had this massive problem that if so-and-so wasn't doing this, if my girlfriend wasn't doing that, I wouldn't be doing the things that I'm doing. And I knew that my life was out of control, and I really didn't know how to stop. And so after the hospital, I went to the rehab center that my parents had gone to, and my brothers. And I went to AA. I didn't feel like I qualified in AA. I didn't go to jail. I'd never really woken up in a dumpster or you know, all these stories that I'd heard in AA. I didn't think it was for me. I was 16. I just was, you know, this is not for me. And so it came time for me to drink, and I couldn't do it though. You know, I couldn't face hurting anybody the way I'd hurt everybody before. You know, and so I stayed dry. And so essentially what I had said was that I'm powerless over alcohol and everyone else's life is unmanageable. You know, that was the statement that I could make. You know, that I was willing not to, I didn't want to hurt anybody else. And so I didn't drink. And it wasn't until June the 16th of this year that I became part of that equation, that I realized that I deserve sobriety. You know, it's not just for everybody else that I do this. You know, I kind of been to meetings here and there, and I didn't have a sponsor, and I didn't work the steps, and, you know, I was suffering from untreated alcoholism. And I came to this meeting because there's an Al-Anon meeting that meets here, and I had gone to Al-Anon, you know, for my family and everything like that, so I thought that would do the trick, and it didn't. It did a lot, and Al-Anon really kept me from being a danger to myself or others for a long time, but it didn't take me where I needed to go. And so I showed up at this meeting, and I started crying and everything, and I went over to the piano to get a sponsor, to ask if I could talk to somebody. And they said, you know, how long have you been sober? And I was like, 7 years or give or take. I don't know. And they're like, okay. And I was like, no, you really don't understand. Like, it's not like that. I'm in a lot of pain, and I really need to talk to somebody. And so then they put me in touch with my sponsor. And I went to the Thursday night meeting where everybody had to say that they were an alcoholic. And and a lot of people may have remembered me at that meeting. And just, I could barely do it. And then I went to a meeting the next day, I think, with Sandy. And Sandy was telling me how that one day I would be of service to people. And I didn't believe him. I sort of was like, you know, that may be cool for you. You might be of service to people, but I really don't think I will, you know. That's for the real alcoholics or something like that. You know, like I didn't really understood what he meant. And so, but then I took direction. You know, I started doing a 90 and 90, and then I started reading the big book, and it was in the big book study. I just was like struck because it told me how to stay sober. And for all this time, I just was like balled up and terrified and white knuckling it and hating myself and hating the world and, thank you, carrying everything with me. And I didn't know how to stay sober anymore. And then they told me there's this book that it's like, it's all there, you know, step by step, how to stay sober. And then after 90 days, it came time for me to speak. And I think that was one of the biggest moments for me in my life when I look at it, because suddenly I felt a part of the group, that I could be of service. You know, my story, however far along I had gone, however much time I had dry versus sobriety, blah, 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 blah. You know, it was my story, and then I could share it with the group, and I could offer myself to the group in a way that I'd never really offered myself to anybody. I had never really been of service to anybody. And suddenly everything was different. And, you know, I went to the Sunday night meeting after I qualified. And I just, thank you. The way I shook the speaker's hand, the way I put a dollar in the basket, I mean, everything was different. And I really felt like I belonged. And it's the same now. And I just, anything that I can ever do for AA, anything that I can ever do, you know, whether it's make coffee, whether it's do anything, I'll do it, because you've just given me so much, and thank you.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Robin.
Thank you, Wilbur. Thank you. Thank you, everybody. My name is Robin Taylor, and I am an alcoholic. God bless you all. I'd like to thank Amanda for asking me to speak. I'd like to thank Peggy and Van for starting the group, the Atlantic Group. I'd like to thank Patty, my sponsor, and I'd like to thank God for giving me the 2 feet to make it here today and a lot of prayers. I'll start at the beginning. My sobriety date is September 21st, 2005. Yes, I just had my first year. Feels great. My alcoholic date when I first started drinking is May 28th, 1973. So I've been an alcoholic for about 33 years. I'm going to start early in my story and progress forward from that. I'm the daughter of a traveling salesman. How many of you saw Paper Moon? Okay, that was me on a good day. Okay, my dad was a traveling salesman. He sold magazine subscriptions out of the car and a Hoover vacuum in the back trunk. I was raised in a car for 8 years. I used to sleep in the front seat, down on the passenger side, and my dad would sleep on the seat above me, and my mother and my older brother would sleep in the back. On a good week, we would sleep in motels and hotels, but he was a chronic alcoholic, and so was my mother. I used to dance in bars for money, for food, and in money for him to drink on. And I had one good dress. It was a Swiss polka dot yellow dress with a little white belt. And I remember people smoking. They were smoking so much in the bars that I couldn't see above their butts. So I would be dancing away, and they'd be throwing change. And Dad would be drinking at the bar and telling stories. This started in about 1954 to about 1958. And during this time, my brother had an air rifle, one of those blow air rifles, those pew. And what he inadvertently had done, he blew out my eardrums, and we didn't know it at the time. And I progressively grew deaf and started to lip read. We stayed a few places in Seattle. We had a lot of geographics in my story, from Paducah, Kentucky, to Whitewater, Wisconsin, to Hartford, Connecticut, to a lot of different bars and places, to migrant working camps, to motels, hotels, just sleeping by the side of the road, but mostly a lot of bar time. So the early 50s were spent on a lot of bars, and my mom and dad didn't get along too well, I must say. They divorced in the early 60s, and my mom went husband hunting. By that time, I had another brother. I had another little brother who was 8 years younger than me. And she would bring these men over to, we moved to Seattle, where I went to a hearing institute. I had a terrible stutter, and I was on a tissue shrinkage pill to regain most of my hearing, which I did over a year and a half, in my right ear, and had some little bit of deafness in my left ear, but over a year and a half I regained my hearing. But, you know, I never wanted to drink. I was so upset by my mom and dad's violence towards each other and everything. I never wanted to be a drinker, never, because I kept pushing the booze bottles back. They kept hitting me in the face in the car, and I didn't know what, I'd be drooling and they'd be dripping, and I'd have, you know, Route 66, you know, tattooed on my face, or I'd have a fish on one side, you know, from the map on the floor, you know, when I would be asleep. So I just never liked the smell. I never liked the taste. I mean, I never tasted it. I always was putting water in the bottles and, you know, trying to keep them from drinking, but I never wanted to be an alcoholic. I never wanted to drink. So I think I came out of the womb a dry drunk, you know, just white knuckling it, you know. I just never wanted to be a drinker. So up until that, you know, May 28th, 1973, I never took a drink. But anyway, my mom remarried. She found this wonderful man who gave us our first poop box house. I call them poop box houses because when you're living in a car, you don't have a house. I mean, you don't have an outhouse. So I always assumed everybody, you know, had a poop box house, you know, that had, and I just, you know, to me that seemed really foreign, people living in poop box houses. So I just thought that was the strangest way to live, you know, when you've been living in a car and motels and hotels and living in, you know, tents by the side of the road. So to me, it was really strange. But we finally got a poop box house. And so I was living in a poop box house for my first Wonder Bread years going through high school. And it was so funny. It was just like The Who, you know, on Thanksgiving dinner. My mom was a closet drinker. She'd hide everything. She'd go, oh my, I got to go freshen up. You know, I just got to go freshen up. 5 minutes already. Well, anyway, my mom was a closet drinker. She'd freshen up all the time. We went all the way home, and you know that beast, and you know the who beast just never got cooked. You know, we'd wait till 10 o'clock, and we still couldn't smell that who beast. Well, anyway, that went on continually, and I'll get to my first drink. My first drink was a pink lady, followed by a pink lady, followed by a strawberry daiquiri, followed by a whiskey sour, followed by a white Russian, followed by a zombie. That was my first drink. And I prayed to the porcelain god for 3 days, had raccoon eyes, and you couldn't get me off the bathroom floor. I was not a nightly drinker, a continuous drinker during the 70s. And Ava, it was so funny when you brought up the disco, the disco thing, you know. I was doing, you know, the line dance, because I couldn't afford to go to dance classes, because it was much cheaper to go to West Hollywood and go to the back lot for $2, you know, and have people buy you drinks, you know, to teach them your style, man, your style, you know. So that was just, you know, that was so much cooler than having give you a margarita, you know, or a vodka gimlet or, you know, whatever. So that's how I got my drinks. And that was during the 70s. So during the 70s, I'd get my drinks that way. And I still wasn't really a boozer. I still was an occasional drinker, wasn't an everyday drinker. And then in the 1980s, I had a brain tumor, and I was working on Broadway, and I had to take some time off. And I crossed the line somewhere during that time. I started to think in the morning, as soon as I got up, where am I going to get my next drink? Where am I going to go drinking tonight after the show? Where am I going to go drinking? So I stepped over the line where I started getting it into my mind where I was going to drink. So that started in the early 80s. I got married, which I didn't tell you, between my junior and senior year of high school for Because back then Boeing and Lockheed were on strike and it was Vietnam. And if you had 50 cents, you could get $52 worth of food stamps. And I had my own apartment. I was living on my own as a junior in high school for $65 a month rent. And so I married this guy and we ended up staying married for 15 years. He's still my dearest friend and his kids call me Robin Hood. And, which is lovely. But anyway, we divorced. We divorced in 1984. It sent me to the loony bin. I tried to commit suicide, and I was in a mental hospital for 4 months where none of the medications worked. I was a vegetative feature, and I had shock treatments. And so I went through that bout of shock treatments, which I still have to this day. They diagnosed me as bipolar. But I got to tell you this quick Halloween story. It's so cool. I was in a straitjacket, and I was in a straitjacket, and they had like Roy Rogers and Dale Evans, and they were in their little gingham red and white little outfit, and they had their portable record player, and we were in the gym, and they wouldn't give us any knives except for or scissors, and so we had to tear all the decorations with our fingers, you know, and tape them to the walls. And so I had my MO orderly behind me, and I was in my straitjacket, and then they put on the hokey pokey. You put your right hand in, you put your right hand out, you put your right hand in, and you shake it all about. You do the hokey pokey, and you turn yourself around. That's what it's all about. I mean, I had to tell you that. It's almost Halloween. It's just so funny. Well, that was a Halloween dance. Well, anyway, I go through the 80s. I get through the 80s. I start drinking more and more. Now I'm on pills. And anyway, I'm on pills. And all I know is that my drinking escalates. It escalates to blackouts during the 90s. I ended up here a year ago in a blackout. I relapsed. I was here for 6 months. I tried to get dry. And 1 minute. I have 1 minute. Thank you very much. I tried to stop drinking for somebody else. That was the big thing. I tried to get stop drinking for my husband, and that took me to relapse. You cannot do that, everybody. You cannot do it. You have to do it for you and for God. You got to do it for you and for God. You got to do it for yourself. You cannot do it for somebody else. You've got to do it for you, and you've got to do it for God. And God's first, and drinking, it's your number one priority. Sobriety is your number one priority in your life. And that's what saved me coming around this second time. I love you all. I want you to have a sober night. I want you to have a sober week. And I'm really surprised I'm talking in front of you, because I thought it was over for me because of a lot of reasons. So God bless you all, and thank you.
Bulletin board. Our main speaker tonight is Kevin.
Thank you very much. My name is Kevin Heaney. I'm an alcoholic. If I'm not standing behind the big book, you don't need to hear anything I have to say. I was incredibly moved. My first drink was Southern Comfort. And I know Robin besides the rooms, and I know what a miracle it is for all of us to be here. I will talk about the big book later on, but first I want to talk about acceptance and forgiveness. There is no place in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous for judgment or condemnation. We should get out of the rooms, because we're destroying the rooms if we're judging and condemning. A lot of you are new. Some of you have failed. Some of us will fail. The most sacred words in the entire body of Alcoholics Anonymous are not in this book, and those words are, keep coming back. If God were to speak, those were the words he would say to us, keep coming back. Nothing you do or will do or didn't do can separate you from me. Keep coming back. I am forever with you, and all that I have is yours. It's very easy to get caught up in the technical parts of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and lose the spirit, which is what Alcoholics Anonymous is. I studied with a spiritual teacher, Joel Goldsmith, and Joel said, you can eat books, but words are not nutritious and they don't taste good. It's the spirit of the author, and it's the spirit that matters. I want to thank the group. I am not a member of the Atlantic Group, but the Atlantic Group has set a high water mark for me in my recovery as long as it's been around. You have made me tighten up my act over and over again. I want to thank Vince for inviting me to speak tonight on a particularly important night in the history of the group. Tonight is the sober anniversary of one of the founders. Tonight is Van's anniversary. I believe it was 29 years would have been tonight. I'll come back to that in just a moment. I am wearing a tuxedo tonight because the Atlantic Group, specifically Ron Black, honored me by asking me to participate in the Big Book study at the Wilson House. There isn't a dress code, which means I was dressed and very nicely, but I wouldn't keep my shoes on. So, Ron, I salute you. I'm wearing a tuxedo to make up for you having to tell me 12 times, put your shoes on, put your shoes on. Before we get to my story, I will tell you what I have now decided is the most important, the most gentle, the most wonderful line in the Big Book. It's not this one, it's the next one. Bill, at the end of his story, writes, "One poor chap committed suicide in my home," and this is the line, "he could not or would not see our way of life." I'm in no position to judge whether someone cannot see our way of life or will not. And I've got a real attitude problem because I handicap drunks. I decide who's a winner and who's a loser. I got no business doing that. I don't know if someone can't get it or if they won't get it. It's real easy to judge and say they're just not trying hard enough. Where do I get off? And if this were not the Atlantic Group, I would be using very powerful four-letter words, which I use very well, which Van actually had a major issue with me on. Van and I admired each other, but he certainly was accurate in taking my inventory on that. My name is Kevin Barry Douglas Heaney. I was born in Flushing, Queens. I'm a native New Yorker, if you count the outer boroughs as constituting native New Yorker. I took my first drink in eighth grade before Memorial Day and found in booze what made me a whole person. It integrated me. It was a wonderful thing that put out the fire that was in my heart. I drank as often as I could from that point on. I came up in the late 60s, so there was a time where alcohol was very passé, and I allowed it to be passé. But the problem was most of the drugs I used made me think, and I thought way too much. So I didn't need drugs that made me more perceptive. I needed drugs that made me simpler, stupider, fuzzier, out of touch. Because if I thought too much, I started thinking about suicide or homicide. And alcohol, actually, though it kills people, it softens it for some of us. By the time I grew up in Connecticut. At the time, it was a 21 state. New York was an 18-year-old state for buying. So it required great challenge. It was much easier when I rolled over into drugs to get drugs than it was to get alcohol. I adore alcohol. Alcohol is a power greater than me that I happily turned myself over to. By the time I'm getting out of high school, I'm drinking every weekend. I have this brief period of 18 months where I am, you know, full flat-out hippie. And I had that ugly, men should not grow their hair long if they have certain kinds of hair look, you know. No amount of showering made the cream rinse come out of it. And I wore headbands, and I thought at the time, as so many of us did, that every joint I smoked was a blow against the administration, and Nixon, on the next bong hit, would resign, and we would, and the age of peace would come in if I dropped enough acid. But booze was what really did it, and I loved it. One of my greatest AA stories was my first home group was the Yorkville group. One of the oldest groups in Manhattan, still is. And it was a round robin. It was a big round robin. And I had been to a meeting that morning, and I didn't know what a round robin meant. I was trying to remember from being a caddy, what the heck is a round robin? And it means the next person, the next person. And it was coming down the table at me, and I was all set for, I had my canned speech. I was going to tell them what I heard in the 79th Street workshop that morning. And as it got closer and closer, I suddenly realized this, it was my first moral crisis in AA. I suddenly wanted a drink. And I thought, oh God, if I tell them I'm going to want it, that I want a drink, they're going to say, get out. You don't belong here. And if I don't tell them that I want a drink, I'm going to be lying to them. And I'm going to do to AA what I've done to everything else that matters to me. I would have lied to it and cheated me out of it. So I'm sitting there, what do I do? If I tell them, you'll make me leave. If I don't tell you, I'll be forcing myself out. And it gets to the woman in front of me. And Claire says, I'm Claire, I'm an alcoholic, and I want to drink, and I love to drink, and it's been 19 years, and I still love to drink. In that moment, Claire opened the doors to heaven for me. Because I could then say, I'm Kevin, I want to drink. AA is not a place for posturing, for voguing, it's a place for truth. The truth will set you free, and BS, didn't say the word, Peggy, will kill you. And I'm incredibly prone to want you to hear the right words from me than I am to tell the truth about me. I really would be rather lonely, but having you, thinking you have a high opinion of me, than ratting myself out and telling the truth. So I found alcohol and it worked. And it continued to work for a long time till I was 29 years old. By the time I'm 25, I start to have some very deep concerns that I love it too much. And I go to social work school and my first internship is on a drug and alcohol unit in a small private hospital in Westport, Connecticut. And I get exposed to this incredible fellowship. I have been in the therapy business pretty much on and off since 1974. I am the director of New York's most prestigious drug and alcohol place. I have trained Freudian, I have trained Jungian, I have trained cognitive behavioral, I have trained hypnotherapy, I have trained in four different types of family. I'm not an Irish Catholic moron in Queens who can't afford therapy. The disease that I suffer from, only an act of God in my soul will free me from. Your therapist at best can help you identify the jagged edges, but only a power greater than me. I'm an alcoholic of the doomed and hopeless variety. That's what the book told me. The first man who taught me AA taught me that point. I'm a hopeless alcoholic because I can't safely drink. I have a physical allergy. When I take the first drink, I take the next drink and the next drink and the next drink. It wasn't that way always, but it became that way. And in the end, if I started, I could not stop. I didn't want to stop. It was beyond my control. I'm a doomed alcoholic because I'm emotionally discontent. I have a soul sickness. I'm too vulnerable. The world, life is too hard. It's too painful. And I need to tranquilize myself. I can't live life on life's terms. So I can't safely drink because I explode into needing more drinks, and I can't live without drinking. The big book tells me that there are two tests. When I really want to stop, can I stay stopped? And when I drink, can I control it? By the time I'm 25, I can't. I come out of this internship. I've been exposed to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I see this beautiful thing. It isn't my time yet. And it's, maybe some of you know this, where you stand at the window, you look in, and you wish you could be in here, but you know you can't let yourself come in yet. Or maybe you talk yourself out of leaving. And leaving AA doesn't necessarily mean picking up. It means disconnecting from the life we have. It's being afraid of having a good life. It's being afraid of being uplifted. That's the kind of fears I suffer from. Yeah, I worry that I'm going to die homeless and eating dog food type of thing, or screaming with a long, protracted illness. But in fact, the biggest fear is getting better. I'm afraid of getting better. I have this deep feeling of unworthiness. AA is to help me with that. So I drink and drink and drink and drink. And around the time Robin is starting to become an alcoholic, I try to address my alcoholism. And I go and I get myself put on antabuse, which is a drug that makes you get sick if you drink. And I stop drinking and I go into therapy and it works real well. And I come back down to the city from Provincetown where I want to drink. And I stopped taking the antabuse, and I didn't get involved with AA because I avoid AA like a vampire avoids a cross. Now, this is alcoholic insanity. I know it works. I know it's beautiful. I've gotten to audit a number of meetings. I know it's what I need, but I won't go. That's alcoholic insanity. Alcoholic insanity is not what I do when I'm drinking. That's chemically altered behavior, substance-induced insanity. Alcoholic insanity is the insanity that lets me stone cold sober do something which is suicidal to my moral, spiritual well-being. And that's alcoholic insanity, and you can't protect me from that. Nothing can save me from that. Because if you handcuff me to something, I'll break loose or pull it with me to the danger spot. So I come back to New York, and I start drinking. Walking over here, I was reminded of the horror when my family had me drinking again. They were so proud of me for that brief period I stopped. But there just was not enough in a life without alcohol. I need the inside job addressed. So I go back to drinking. I spend from 77 to 82 drinking and mild drugging at this point. Drinking was everything. And I come back in again. And it's a funny thing. What makes us come here? This whole thing, the desire to stop drinking. You know, you want to ponder something forever. Ponder that. What is it? I mean, if my drinking is working, I'm going to keep doing it. Or if it doesn't hurt me so deeply that I... And what is that except a gift? That it's unbearable to be me anymore, so I'm willing to let you take over in some way for me. I can't explain it, but I'm the beneficiary of it. Something made me want to stop. Some of you, probably many of you, have lower bottoms than I did, but something made me come in to a room and the drink obsession left. This is an important public service announcement. Pay attention if you're new. I stopped drinking alcohol, but I still played around with a little marijuana and a little cocaine. It took me 2.5 years to change my clean date from the 13th day of June to the 7th day of November. If you're sitting here tonight and you're not drinking, but you are taking illicit drugs, or simply said, if you can sniff it, snort it, shoot it up, shove it up, get it into your system in any way to change your mood without a bona fide doctor's prescription, your day counts zero. We play hardball here. Because ultimately, I will go back to the one I really want to go back to. It was important for me to change my time. A day count will let you get a year, and counting your years will let you start counting days again. Forget it. It's only this day, and if that's too much, this second that I'm clean. And I'm only clean and sober because of the grace of God and the kindness of you people, and I must stay connected to both. I didn't do this. It was a gift. And to see it any other way is just egotism and will get me back out. Or let me have a long life of quiet desperation where I wish I was dead for many years. Those are our choices. There is no middle ground for those if you identify with me. And if you don't, I respect you. I envy you. But this is the way I'm constructed. So I'm 2.5 years in AA. My time is really not 2.5 years, but we won't belabor that point. I've got the job I want, the girlfriend I want, the material stuff has come together. I haven't started the inside job, the 12 steps. I have physical abstinence, but I haven't grown spiritually or emotionally. And what happens is life. And the funny thing is, heaven and hell have the same address. It's just the eyes that I see them with that makes the difference. And my life became hell. And I started to think not about drinking. I had enough AA deep inside of me that I didn't think about drinking. I thought about suicide. And one particularly gorgeous August morning, I didn't want to live anymore. But I had smart enough feet that took me to the 79th Street workshop, where I met a man who I knew who would become my buddy, my mentor. He was never formally my sponsor. He was briefly my lover. And he taught me this book. And he taught me that there are 194 promises in it. And he taught me how to read it and put it into my life. He was an uplifted spirit. The orange and black is also because I love Halloween. I will conclude by talking about the Halloween aspects of alcoholism. But first, and spooks and spirits and things that go bump in the night. But I first need to understand that what I suffer from is not a physiological problem or a psychological problem. It is a spiritual disorder. And I need to understand that my obsessions of the mind, my inability to be happy, and my turning to a material substance to make me happy is a human trap. The solution that I'm offered through the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, is a way to awaken my heart and soul to become what I've always been, which is God's kid, to get freed of the obsessions of the mind that say I'm garbage or trash, and let that grace pour out and let me be of service and let me have this life that's better than any drug imagined fantasy I had. Keith taught me this. He's a nobody in New York would know him. He died of the virus 15 years ago. But if you know me or anyone I've ever sponsored or anyone I've worked with, his spirit is here. I told my friend from California who was with me over the weekend that I would be talking tonight and that I'd be talking about my heroes in AA, many of whom are dead. Van is one of them. And he said, tell them that we stand on the shoulders of giants, but sadly, we stand on the gravestones of giants because they die. They pass away. But our traditions cover that. It is the spirit. It is the principles. That Keith died of AIDS, that Keith could not change his sexual acting out, does not change one word of the principles he taught me in this book. Though I had to do a whole lot of work to come to terms with how could this man have been such an important force in my life and have had this happen to him. Which is why you want to judge an AA, you're out of AA. Maybe they won't take your card away, but you're out of AA. You can only be in AA in an acceptance and loving attitude and posture. Can I serve you? Can I help you? Anything else? There are times we have to be strong. There are times I need clear direction, and there are times I need to give clear direction. But it's got to be tempered with love and acceptance. And I can't even get that out of me. I've got to close my eyes and squeeze myself and say, God, show me how to do this. Because I like to rough them up. I like to be as brutal as my father was. Somehow, in some sick way, I think that balances. It doesn't. AA is about a course of action. AA is about me starting by admitting I am powerless over alcohol, that I can't control whether it's in me or keeping it out of me. My life is unmanageable, which is an ongoing state, and I am insane. And the insanity is believing that I can make peace, that I can force a solution, that I can win on my terms, that I can make myself happy by getting the things I want. There's an NA named Usman from Jersey City who says the true meaning of the first step is to explode the belief that there can ever be a material solution to a spiritual problem. There is no thing in this world, no car, no sex posture, no revenue source that will ever provide lasting happiness for someone like me. I will get thrown out of the Garden of Eden time and again. I'll pick a fight with the busboy in heaven and get bounced. You can't make me happy. The me that I'm talking about is my defects of character. That's like saying my tumor needs more attention. I haven't loved it enough today. No, my tumor, my defects need to be cut out, irradiated out, blasted out of me because they are not me. It's a distorted concept of me that's got to be fed. Believe it or not, you will not die if you're not recognized. I will not die if I never get that kinky sex that's always at the tip of my tongue. It's hard to accept, ladies and gentlemen, but there is true fulfillment out there in life on life's terms, not my wish list being met. And that requires a decision to turn my will and my life over and to get what comes. The funny thing about the AA book is a number of times it says once the person really decides to do this, you don't even have to be that far into the work, I start to feel the effects. If I really say, take me out of this, make me stop this, help me, God, make me want what I don't even want, it starts to work within me. It's so amazing. Only a loving higher power could be doing this. But you see, I BS all the time. I plea bargain. I act as though I'm surrendered. I make it look as though I'm sincere. I'm a phony. You know, but only I suffer. But the funny thing is, I really believe all we do is postpone what's ours anyhow. that the pot of gold is in our own heart, and the AA way opens it up. Once I've made this decision to turn myself over and I do this fourth step inventory, and the fourth step's so clear, these are the parts in me that are blocking me from what? Blocking me from my higher power that I get to define as I mean it. I tell this story to someone else. They help me figure out what are the usual suspects, the defects that rob me of joy, that ruin your life too while I'm at it. And then I get to 6 and 7, where I get to be entirely ready to see that as long as I continue to be angry, prideful, slothful, there will be no lasting pleasure. Hell, it won't even be the second of pleasure. And then I get to humbly ask, make me want what I don't want. Take me to a better place even though I don't want to go. Isn't it insane how I resist going to better places? Maybe I'm not alone in this. And then we get to making amends to others. I really believe that everything I've said up to this point is meaningless until I can be entirely ready and show up at your door to talk about the harm I did to you, to own my fault in it, to see what it was, and to do everything I can to make it right with a checkbook, with my best heart's intent, and to understand that I'm honor-bound from that moment on to try to keep things as right as possible. And that means twisting me like a pretzel because my ego comes back in. One of my great dilemmas in life was, what am I here for? What is the purpose of life? This existential, angst-filled, doubt-filled pain. That's an ideal growing environment for alcoholism. Into the light is where I have to be. The question of what am I here for, the book answers it in the 8th step section. To fit myself to be of maximum usefulness to God and my fellows, to others. And the defects are lifted not so that my migraine of sexuality goes away. The defects lifted so that I can be of service to others. Now, this is the insane part. If you're brand new, watch the sleight of hand here. If you work at making others happy, you will be happier than having them work on you. It's the most amazing thing. It's turning the thinking upside down. It is not by getting that I'm made happy. It's by giving. I promise you, I can give you 1,000 examples, yet I'll flip back to that right away. I'll flip back to thinking getting is where it's at. Why? Because I suffer from distorted thinking, a disease of the mind which will manifest in booze or something else. The purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous is for us to have this incredible life right now. Whether that means we are just barely getting by, whether our dreams have been shattered, whether some of our bodies are never going to get better, whether other loved ones have left us and will never come back, AA's promise is joy now. There is no heaven. There is no afterlife in our system. That's not good enough for drunks. We had to drink now. We need joy now. And that's the purpose of the fellowship and the program. How am I on time? Then let me talk about, it's a spiritual disorder. As a kid, I was so scared by those horror movies. And the funny thing is, they all contain profound truth. The werewolf is me under the influence. You know, the light of the moon, me drinking, and suddenly a decent or semi-decent person is transformed into a dangerous animal. Or this vampirism, that I am driven into being a night creature, you know, who does these depraved things in the pursuit of alcohol. And what is the answer? It is to find the light. I have had, if you're new in this room, pay attention. You will meet angels. You will meet uplifted souls. You will meet Jesuses and Buddhas in very human form. I have been the beneficiary of tremendous light. And I don't mean they weren't human. My dear friend, my important figure, Keith, died. Bill Baldwin died, Van died, Warren Higginbotham died, Bob Bilheimer died, Sparky died, but the truth they left me lives on if I hold it sacred and live with it. I'll close with Van's St. Francis prayer, but there was a man named Durr once. Durr confronted me after I walked out of a step meeting because they weren't on the step, and Durr said to me, Kevin, you went home and were depressed and angry. I stayed at the meeting and enjoyed myself. You went home because he wasn't on the step. I went where the speaker was. It was very pleasant. Sparky when the woman who I got sober for left me said, "Be kind, Kevin, be kind. Years from now, you won't regret not telling her off, but you'll be proud that you were kind to her." Sparky also said over and over again, he would say to me, "Never, but never, but never pass up the opportunity to say nothing." Warren Higginbotham, who was an old Lenox Hill dog and one of the founders of the Friday Night Men Step, said, "Kevin, if you use this 10th step today, you won't need 8 and 9 tomorrow." And I would start to explain to Warren, "Warren, I think," and in his little South Carolina voice, he'd say, "Kevin, that's your problem. You're thinking again." And cut me off, because that is my problem. I'm thinking again. Bill Baldwin used to tell me to give 110% to the AA program, the AA fellowship, AA service, AA literature. He would say, "You're an effed up alcoholic, Kevin, but we've got a program exactly designed for someone like you." And then Bill would end the phone calls, and any of you who ever called him would know this. He would say, "Call me again, will you?" As though it mattered to him that I called. He made me want to call. He made me feel like I was important to him. That's love in action. Bob Bilheimer used to say, "Don't deny someone the dignity of finding their bottom. Don't try to cut them off. Just be there with the answer." And Van, I had the honor of speaking at Van's memorial service. I couldn't think of a single statement, but Phil and I were talking recently, and Van's point of give 110% with no expectation of return. Because the one who really gives the returns sees, notices, and you've already been given, Kevin. It's in the giving of it that we liberate ourselves and free ourselves. I'll conclude with one thing. Some of you may know I do this Avon Breast Cancer Walk. I walk it alternate years and crew it. And I'd been on the walk and preparing for 6 months, and I realized the week before the walk was over, oh my God, the walk's going to end. I've trained physically 12, 13, 16 hours a week, and it's going to end, and I've got nowhere to go, and I'm going to be so depressed. And I realized I've got to transform some of this energy into a deeper commitment to my prayer life. And I told a number of people, and they said, "That sounds great." I said, "I'll try to put 30 to 50% of it into an increased prayer life." And then I called someone, Mike Pelletier, who's been sponsoring me. And I told this to Mike, and Mike said, "Kevin, that's ridiculous. This walk is your prayer life. Your sponsorship is your prayer life. You can't increase your prayer life. You're living your prayer life. And we've got to get past this idea of a disintegrated life. There's no less prayer in the way I shake your hand or smile at you than there is in if I'm doing the Catholic sacraments or Buddhist meditation. There's no separation. There's no separation between me and you and God if I'm open to it. It's just a lie that lets me feel isolated and that there's something lacking. The truth is, you gotta find in your own heart what booze seem to offer." Thank you very much.